Thank you for coming to chat with us. I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So Jacob, I don't know if you wanted to introduce this one or if I should introduce it. What's your preference?
I'll just say a little background and maybe you can talk about the specifics. But one thing Max and I and Sophia and Max's dad have been talking about is it's sort of like the von Hippel family has a lot of biologists and stuff in it, and that we've had a difficult time figuring out what the definition of computation actually is. And it's not really just computers and writing little programs that you can post on GitHub and are cool. It feels broader than that. And I've been getting increasingly interested in some of the parallels after reading this book on Jennifer Doudna and like history of CRISPR and stuff. So hopefully we can have some more biologically themed talks overall and explore this sort of new concept for a bunch of us computer people.
Cool, and maybe we should explain what a cafe is because not everybody here has gone to one. Sure. So we organize the standard events everybody goes to, but we also occasionally do these cafe events, which are often much smaller. They're sometimes organized like 10 minutes beforehand. And instead of like posting publicly, we're gonna have an event, everyone come. It's usually more like, if we're having an event on some theme, we might ping three or four people who do that thing and say, hey, do you wanna have like a quick talk? And they're kind of informal. There might be slides, but as you'll see, they're not exactly the world's most professional slides. And the idea is more like if we were going to a cafe in Boston and talking about our research or talking about things that interest us, and a little bit less of kind of the formal, rigorous presentation. So this is one of those events and is part of our new series of cafe events on biological topics as they relate to computation. So Sophia is kind of kicking us off with a chemistry talk, which I'm binning into biology because it's the foundations of all biology. Mm-hmm. So I guess with that, we'll let Sophia take it away. It's not a super long talk, but I think it's an interesting topic and there's probably a decent amount of discussion to be had afterwards. So we'll just go ahead. And if you guys have questions, feel free to interrupt, but know that because of the way the talk is structured, most of your questions are probably gonna be kind of incrementally answered very rapidly after you think of them. Mm-hmm. Cool. So I'll let Sophia take it.
All right. Well, before I start, I'll say I made the slides and then Max cleaned them up a little bit.
Emphasis on a little bit.
Just a little bit. So if there's anything typed up, you can see my work is what's underneath the typewritten words. So what I'm talking about today is this problem that drives me nuts as a chemistry student, which is how incredibly illogical chemical nomenclature seems to be. And this is a really big deal because as someone who studies chemistry, I have to talk about a lot of different kinds of substances and molecules. And oftentimes when someone says the name of a molecule, I have no idea what they're actually referring to. And I have to look it up to figure out what it means. So I'm gonna quickly go over the very, very, very basic tenets of chemistry so that everyone can kind of track what we're talking about. And then I'll kind of explain the problem here. So when we're talking about our building blocks for chemistry, the first thing is protons, and those are positively charged subatomic particles that are in atoms. And protons are denoted in two main ways. Usually it'll be like a plus sign in a circle to denote a positive charge, or it'll be an H plus. And the reason why is because the hydrogen element, when it has a positive charge, all there is a proton. To be neutral, it needs one electron, but if the electron's gone, you have an H plus. So we'll often use those synonymously. All right, so then neutrons, they're neutral, as you might assume. Those are also in the nuclei of atoms. And then our last one are electrons. Electrons have the most variety in the way that they're portrayed. You can have an E with a negative sign. You can have a negative sign in a circle, or most commonly, as I'll show you, a dot. And usually these will be dots like in a Lewis structure where they're around the atom and they kind of tell you the charge state of the element you're looking at. And then all of these come together to form an atom, which is the smallest unit of matter that has a chemical element. If you ever look at the periodic table, those are all different elements and each element is a type of atom. So hopefully that makes sense. Okay. Yeah, that's exactly what I just said.
Well, let's pause for a moment. So an element is a class of atoms characterized by the number of protons. So that's an important point here, right? So, if you consider all of the possible atoms in the universe, or even ones that are maybe physically impossible, that have, say, three protons, that would be a particular
element. Anything with three protons will still be that same element. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a sec.
Yeah.
Okay. So then a molecule is two or more atoms that are bonded to each other. An obvious example would be water. You have two hydrogens and an oxygen. And when I draw this, there's a line between the hydrogens and the oxygen, and each line is a bond. So that's what that means. Okay. And then this kind of relates to what Max was talking about, isomers. So isomers are atoms that have the same elemental identification, but they can have different molecular masses. And the reason why is because an element is not defined by the amount of neutrons in it. So you can have a hydrogen atom with no neutrons, and that would just be hydrogen, or its isomer, deuterium, has one proton and one neutron. So they're isomers of the exact same element, but they still have kind of independent names, and you can differentiate them based off of mass. As far as the bigger scale of molecules, they'll be anything with the same molecular formula. So they're composed of the same elements in the same amount. However, they can have differences in conformation, stereochemistry, or mass. So conformation would be the way that they are bonded to each other and the shape that they take on. And then stereochemistry refers to the angles that they take on. So a very common example here would be hydrogen and deuterium, where deuterium weighs 1 gram per mole more than hydrogen does. All right, so how do we represent molecules on paper? Pretty simple. When you have a line, just like I said earlier, that's a bond. If you have two lines, that's two bonds. Three lines, three bonds. We usually don't go past that.
And Sophia, you haven't said the word bond. So what is a bond?
A bond, let's think of a very simple way to put this. A bond is like a shared space between two atoms in which their electrons have a greater volume of space that they can inhabit and thus gain stability, which makes those two atoms be more stable when they are close to each other. Of course, if they get too close to each other, that results in a decrease in stability and they're repelled from each other. And you know, the opposite happens when they get farther away, you decrease stability again, so they get attracted to each other again. So when there's a bond, that's really like this perfect stable place where they're able to be close to each other in a way that the energy of all the electrons decreases.
So a triple bond would be when there are three electrons whose orbitals have somehow changed because of the atoms being closer to each other, right?
Three electrons from each element involved. So when you have a single bond, mm-hmm. you have one electron from each atom on either side of the bond.
So there's two electrons involved.
Two electrons and one.
Okay, so a triple bond would be six electrons.
Total, yes.
Whose orbitals have changed.
Yes.
And there's probably some threshold where you say, like, if the probability distribution of the orbital has changed more than this amount, mm-hmm. then we say it's changed enough for us to consider it a bond.
Exactly, like yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe this is a difficult question to answer. If it goes too far into the weeds, don't worry about it. But are there some, like, general rule of thumb things that cause a bond? Because why do they want to share electrons? Why don't they just want to be their separate pieces? It's something about getting the electrons to like 8 or 18 or something, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what they'll teach you in general chemistry if you're a freshman in college, but it's kind of bullshit. Those are like, you know, rules that are actually trends that people notice and then they go by. But the actual reason why is because when the electrons are in between the nuclei, they shield each other and reduce the effective nuclear charge. And so the protons in those nuclei, they're always repelling each other. However, the protons in one element are attracted to the electrons in another one. And so at certain distances, depending on which elements you have, when you have those electrons in between the two nuclei, they shield the nuclei from each other enough that the attractions between the electrons and the nuclei overcome the repulsions between the nuclei themselves. And that corresponds to kind of a increased volume, or we call it delocalization of space that the electrons inhabit within a certain kind of probability that you accept. And that all together leads to increased stability of the system.
That's interesting. So that's the same thing that a regular element holds on to electrons for. It's the same reason, but just sometimes it means that you have two that combine in these complex ways, right? Or no?
Not exactly, because an atom on its own, it's in that case only about the interplay between the electrons and the protons within that one atom, versus mm-hmm. in this system, you have two sets of each. And so it's a little bit more complex, but there is kind of this idea that the electrons are attracted to the protons, and that's what keeps them together. So in that
okay, way. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you, Sophia.
Yeah. So when we draw these, any atom that is not a carbon or a hydrogen is drawn in. So in this molecule, I drew in oxygen as an L, and we call anything that's not a carbon or a hydrogen a hetero atom.
But Sophia, if the element on the periodic table was called like mango, you would have written an M or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So and that O happens to look like a circle, which happens to be a symbol, but mm-hmm. in this case, it's just a coincidence. That's an O for oxygen.
Yeah, and the periodic table shows the symbol for every single element. Okay. Every single one has its unique signal.
Yeah.
Okay. So here, if we have a joint, like right at the center, then that is an implied carbon. And in this case, you can see that there's four bonds coming out of the carbon, and carbon can only take on four bonds under normal earthly conditions. And so the basic assumptions that chemists make, and if this isn't true, we will always show the full structure. But when the assumptions are true, we're able to condense it. And we say, don't write in the hydrogens. Instead, they are implied. So if you look at the carbons on the end, and here, let me circle it, like this guy that I just highlighted, that one has three bonds to hydrogens that are just implied and they're not drawn in. And while this doesn't seem super like intuitive or obvious now, it can actually make a little bit more sense when you see the fully drawn out structure, because this is as small of a molecule as we really get. And it's already looking kind of bulky when we draw in the hydrogens. So you could imagine that if we draw in all the hydrogens every time, it's almost impossible to read. It's just so bulky. So chemists will accept either format, the one on the top or the one on the bottom, but we really prefer the top one because it's so much easier to read. And you just have to remember that the joints are carbons and each carbon has four bonds, or there'll be a charge that'll say why it doesn't have four bonds.
Now, Sophia, if this was missing one of the hydrogens, mm-hmm. You would still call it the same thing, right? Because in some sense, it identifies as the thing that has more hydrogens, meaning that given enough time and normal conditions, it'll find one and attach to it, right?
Yeah. So what we would do is we'd give that molecule and put a positive charge on it.
Okay.
Because it's lost that electron.
Like where the missing one was.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. All right. And as I was saying, whenever it's anything more complex, you know, anything with charges, or when there's not a set of two electrons, there's only one, we always draw it. So this is hydroxide, and, you know, it's in water. And we draw on the negative charge, and we draw on all six of the valence electrons that are not in bonds. And so this way, you know, if you're an organic chemist and you want to know how something is reactive, you can look at it and immediately understand what its behavior is going to be. Okay, a quick note on stereochemistry. That refers to kind of the angular perspective of the molecules. When we draw a wedge, like the one that's blacked in there, that means it's coming out of the page and the dashes go into the page. And the reason why this matters is because, as you can see on those two molecules at the bottom, they're not equivalent. If you switch the dashes and the wedges around, you actually get a different molecule. And this is true for any chiral center or any place that has handedness. And by handedness, what I refer to is like, if you superimpose one of your hands into your other one, they wouldn't actually be the exact same thing. They're mirror images, but if you take them on top of each other, they're different shapes. It's the same thing with these.
Or if you like hold something between your fingers to mm-hmm. get a three-dimensional shape, right? As you rotate,
yeah.
that thing is still rotating to face a different direction or something.
Exactly.
So this is like a classic idea from group theory for those of you who've done symmetry groups and stuff like that, that you can have two kind of symmetric structures, but one of them cannot become the other one under any of your available operations.
Yeah. And
Sophia, why do we care about this? What is the famous reason why we give a shit about stereochemistry?
Well, for a lot of reasons. A big reason is that in biochemistry, a molecule with one stereochemistry and its isomer with a different stereochemistry will react differently in your body. And so we have quite a few historical examples of this problem. And one was actually when a whole bunch of pregnant women got given toxins because a medication that was supposed to have just one-handedness actually had both. And one of them was a good medication, but the other one caused them to become ill and caused birth defects. So it matters a lot. It also matters in scent. When we smell things, the stereochemistry of the molecule makes a huge difference in how we perceive it. And in biochemistry, a lot of our cellular receptors will only accept one form of the molecule, not the other.
So then Sophia explains all this to me while I'm like 4 beers in. Mm-hmm. And I say, so Sophia, once I've diagrammed a molecule, how do I know what to call it so that other researchers will unambiguously know what I'm talking about? And I have to kind of repeat this question a few different ways before she realizes that this is like a thing you would expect because she's so accustomed to her shitty field where they haven't figured this out.
Okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt. It looked like Alberto had a question.
Oh, go ahead.
I think you can just jump in if you want, Alberto. Or at least you hit the raise hand button.
I had a brief question just about the definition of the word page on the previous one. I wasn't sure if that was something specific or something in the previous one before that, actually. Dashes into page, out of page. I don't know what page is in this
one. Oh, so it's like the way that we describe it, this is kind of the way that we describe it to freshman chemistry students because we're learning how to visualize molecules. So it's like if you drew it on a piece of paper, then the wedge is the thing that would come up from the piece of paper and the dash is the thing that would go down into
I see. This is the three-dimensional.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
We can visualize the handedness idea very easily with my handy dandy switchblade.
Great.
So if my switchblade is in my hand like this, right, pointing forward, then it doesn't matter how I rotate it, my hand is never going to make the shape of the switchblade in my left hand pointing forward, right?
Yeah.
This is a different shape, no matter how it's rotated from this. They're both equally scary, but one of them is the left-hand version and one is the right-hand version. And that is the handedness idea.
And Max, that's why you carry your switchblade around.
Explaining group theory to people.
Oh my God, Max needs any excuse he can get to play with that thing. Okay. All right, so I hate UPAC, I'll just say that now. But the normal chemistry response to Max's question is you can follow the rules of UPAC. And so maybe we can discuss this. So UPAC is the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. And luckily they have met over, 50 or 60 years to put together a list of rules for how to write the names of molecules so that there is one correct name for every molecule. And so that we can all read it and understand what it means and that you can always derive the correct name.
Well, just before I continue, so that you guys understand, this would be like coming up with a normal form for the type of molecules. So you have the data structure, which we just showed on the page, which is this, multidimensional thing. And now you want to have a normal form of that type in type theory. And that's what they're attempting to do so that there's only one way to write down the molecule and not 30 ways to write down the molecule. Because when you write it down flat as a word, like aceta, eta, eta, metal, methylclane, that needs to translate to some shape as opposed to like having 30 different words for the thing. And then you can never find any papers from other people studying the same shit as you.
Right, yeah.
And interestingly, getting into this, it's sort of funny that this ends up being a problem because a lot of times in math, finding a way to represent something as a normal form leads to discoveries or really interesting questions.
Yes.
So that I'm curious to hear what happens.
All right. So luckily, UPAC has written the green book called Quantities, Units, and Symbols in Physical Chemistry, which is about 250 pages of rules for how to write quantities, units, and symbols. They also wrote the red book, Nomenclature of Inorganic Chemistry, which is 377 pages long and is rules for nomenclature in inorganic chemistry. Okay, also the gold book, that's general chemical terminology, a whopping 1,670 pages. And we've got the orange book, which is analytical nomenclature, another 964 pages. So I think you guys can see where I'm going here. It's not an awesome situation. We've got the white book, we've got the blue book, We've got the purple book and the silver book. This adds up to a lot of pages of rules, and somehow they're not all in agreement with each other. So if I follow the orange book directions, I might come out with a different term than if I use the gold book. And also, I don't have time to read all of this.
And also, it's not implemented in like a software tool. So like there are kind of things where you can look them up online, but there isn't like a standardized tool put out by IUPAC where you could like program up your molecule and press, what the fuck is it? And it'll tell you, right? They don't do that. And I don't know this for a fact, but I'd be willing to bet pretty much anything I own that nobody's actually attempted to use something like Alloy to generate counterexamples that don't have a name. So like probably, or that don't have a unique name, right?
Yeah.
Probably it's just that as chemists encounter something that doesn't have a name or doesn't have a unique name, they update the rules to handle that edge case, but it's not like they are algorithmically determining the edge cases of their terrible multi-thousand page algorithm.
And another thing I'll say is that I'm a senior undergraduate chemistry student, you know, not a PhD, nothing like that. And I have already discovered numerous molecules where you can write it following all the rules in two or three different ways. And according to the rules, it all means the same thing.
I think Alex has a question.
Alex?
Mic issue. I had a device open and something else. Anyway, the bar shouldn't be unique name, it should be a preferred name, right? Like, many cases will come up where, you know, by starting on one end or another end, you will definitely have some, multiplicities of names, but there's like, the bar is like, there's hypothetically some resolution mechanism. That means you can always select the most applicable one, is the idea with UPAC, right?
Ideally, it would be nice if that
was true,
but there could be disagreements or discordances in what's like most preferable, right? So, but also just even if that is what they somehow successfully implemented, it's too many pages, it's ridiculous. I mean, the entire grammar for the C programming language, which is fucking Turing complete, is like a few hundred lines. So, or maybe 1,000 lines, but I mean, it's not that big. So it doesn't make any sense that you can do Turing complete computations. You can simulate like anything in the universe with a language that's not that complicated, but you can't even diagram a molecule with a language, you know, and get unique names quickly.
No. Another problem with the UPAC system is that situations arise in which you cannot derive the structure from the name because there can be more than one structure available. And this has to do with stereochemistry because the names will include information about stereochemistry, but it often is in such a vague way where it can be interpreted in two directions. And so in that case also, it is not ideal.
So let's see an example.
All right. So I'm gonna use the example of acetyl-CoA. This is a really, really important molecule. I'm studying for the MCAT right now. I see this molecule every single day. So here's the drawing of what it looks like. And while this might look like a big molecule to you guys, like this is a small one, it's simple, it's easy to draw. A chemist looks at this and is like, phew, not a protein. Thank God. Pretty small. So why do we care about acetyl-CoA? It participates in the citric acid cycle, in cellular respiration, in fatty acid metabolism, in steroid synthesis, in synthesis of acetylcholine, which is necessary for basically all neural messages, and in melatonin synthesis. So without acetyl-CoA, we would not live. Humans would not exist without acetyl-CoA. We would, you know, reach equilibrium and die instantly. Okay, so what is the official UPAC name for acetyl-CoA? That's cute, Max.
Thanks.
He edited this, thanks. Uh-huh. So that's him thinking. This is the name. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm 3.5 years into studying this. And when I look at this, it means nothing to me at all.
We have programming languages that make stuff that looks like this. And they always have names like BrainFuck. And they're like used on CodeGolf.com, you know, Stack Exchange on CodeGolf.com. And like, they're sort of basically jokes.
Yeah. So the molecule that I showed you, the drawing of it, it's not that complex, but this is really, really complicated. And it's not super logical. And one of the reasons why it's not super logical is that of the rules, there are, you know, like there are certain words that you can use that you're supposed to use according to UPEC, but UPEC also allows you to use a pile of synonyms because the chemists don't follow directions and use those synonyms anyway. And so often what you get is you get kind of a mix up of different words where some of them are the colloquial words and some of them are the official ones, but they're all in the UPEC name for some reason. So it's just a pile of dog shit. All right. So human proteins can be up to 3,700 times the size of that molecule. And the number of possible molecules is bound by the quantity of matter available in the universe. So not every possible molecule could exist because we don't have enough matter for that. So I'm sure you guys can see that there's a reason why we don't use the UPAC nomenclature, why chemists call it acetyl-CoA. Because at least when you see acetyl-CoA, you can recognize that, read it, and write a sentence with it. So then this comes to the big question, which is how can we communicate the identity of molecules in a universally readable way? And we have some desirable properties. One is that when you read the name, you know what it is, and you don't have to look it up. So in some way, the name has to imply the structure. And either that there is one way to name something, or that if there are multiple ways, it is easy to compute all the possible names. It should also be easy to map from a name to a diagram or from a diagram to a name. And very large molecules should not have very large names because you know you don't want a paragraph long name in the middle of a sentence. That's unreadable. So that's the problem that Max and I have been discussing. I don't have an answer for how to do this. I'm mostly just annoyed with how things are right now. And yeah, we were wondering about your thoughts on this.
And with that, we'll open it up to discussion.
Awesome. So that, thank you. That was an awesome presentation. I don't have any fully formed thoughts about this yet, but one thing it's really reminding me of is Unicode. How many of you have heard of that? Okay, Max has heard of it, Anthony, and presumably a few others. But Sophia, you haven't heard of that, right?
No.
Okay, well, it's not super complicated. Pretty much when we were first doing stuff with computers, people were like, wow, it would be really cool if we could have letters so we can read what's happening on all these transistors and stuff. So they said, I know what, let's clump these in groups of eight. So if you have each of these bits can store a zero or a one. So you have 2^8 possibilities, which gives you space for 256 things. And they said, perfect. Let's go through and fit lowercase, uppercase alphabets, your some special things for new lines, whatever. You can fit into that 256. So each different number represents one of those values, which is like kind of gross, but pretty practical. And then as computers became more and more important, people built this thing with really good intentions that seemed very similar to the chemistry intentions here, where they said, well, not everyone uses English. There are a lot of other languages with special characters. And what if people want to do things like emojis? So Unicode is this giant project that's horrifically complex, source of tons of bugs and vulnerabilities, like people's programs break because of it. And pretty much they said, you know, it would be a great idea if we could have one codex for computers that lets them use any emoji character ever created, or any Chinese character you can think of, or anything in Arabic or English.
Sanskrit.
And yeah, so it stands, yeah, exactly. It has so many things that it's become this impossible to maintain project. And I don't think there are any implementations that handle every case in every situation.
And also it's similar to chemistry in that it has a kind of stereochemistry type of problem, which is that it turns out, okay, imagine a bunch of white guys who only speak English build a system. Mm-hmm. They might imagine that all languages don't have tildes, don't have umlauts, don't have other things like that. And then someday they go to the Mexican restaurant and they're like, oh my gosh, we forgot about Enye. So then they decide, okay, we're going to make it so that you can like add one of these things on top of a symbol. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out one, you like, people start adding things on top of symbols that were not intended to have shit on top of them. Like what happens if you try to add something on top of a symbol that fills the entire square?
Yeah.
Right. How does your rendering engine handle that? Mm-hmm. And then two, turns out there's some languages where the symbols stretch across multiple letters.
Oh.
So you could have like a language where there's a tilde that's like across three letters or mm-hmm. something like that. And then there are very like kind of eccentric people who like to have fun writing things that they can post on like Twitter or Reddit or whatever that basically break the website because the text will sprawl all over the place and extend outside the bounds.
Wow.
Because they are exploiting these problems. Like, what if you put a tilde on a tilde on a tilde on a tilde? And the next thing you know, you have this chain of symbols that goes way off the page and they just copy pasted something into Twitter and it broke Twitter. Wow. And so this is sort of like how people have not really bothered to like break the IUPAC rules sufficiently.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing. I'm curious about your opinion on that, Julia. Sorry for Julia. What am I saying? Sophia. But yeah, because I don't know if it's a similar problem or not. It sounds like it to me, but
yeah, it is a similar problem to an extent. And part of what makes it similar is that UPEC allows for all of these add-ons. There's prefixes and there's suffixes and you know, for different isomers, there are different prefixes you'll use. And then you denote the stereochemistry. And alarmingly, we have three different systems for stereochemistry and none of them actually mean the same thing. So there's R versus S, there's E versus Z, and there's L versus D. And all of those are derived differently. So it's not like D is synonymous with R or anything like that. And they get mixed up too. And so sometimes you'll be using like the EZ stereochemistry within a bracket that is R or S. So it is a very similar problem, yeah.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. From a pharmaceutical brand management perspective, where the brand itself is either a cutesy name or something that's easy to remember, is there UPEC restrictions on the phonetics of the branded pharmaceutical, because maybe a sound could menialize the effects, like, oh, it's only a little bit all of these effects by the sound of it, like an intuit or the psychological sound of the pharmaceutical,
like how ibuprofen is not a chemical name,
yeah, right,
is a brand name.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
So I mean, ibuprofen is an example where that would be like acetyl-CoA. It's a common name that is used. A lot of these are brand names, but they become common names. If I'm in a lab and I'm making ibuprofen, I'm making ibuprofen. And so the answer is really yes and no. When they're referring to the molecule by the UPAC standard, it's the same name that anyone else is using, or it's one of the group of names that you would use following those rules. However, it's totally within your right to make up another name and sell it by that name as a product for your company.
And then you get the Kleenex effect, right? Because you will now use the term ibuprofen, yes, even though it is not in the IUPAC terminology.
Exactly. Yeah. Jefferson, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
I guess my question is, what other attempts have there been to try and do this? To try and, you know, what other nomenclatures might there be for chemistry?
Right, so, now? There is one other big one that was attempted called SMILES. SMILES sucks. It's awful. It's like slightly better than UPAC, but it's really, really difficult to look at that and figure out what it's saying. I think it especially does a bad job of showing the bond structures, because SMILES, the way that it's written is as a list of elements. And then when there's a double bond or a triple bond, they'll put in, you know, the double bond or the triple bond, and then there's parentheses. But as you can imagine, linear molecules are very rare. And so it's the way that they've implemented it. I don't know if there's theoretically a way that could be good to do this, but the way that they've implemented it is kind of awful in saying like, oh, this carbon is bonded to this other one that's halfway down the name of the molecule, and there's this other group over here and that's bonded to this thing over here. So it's not very readable.
Notice, by the way, that math has the same problem, right? If you write a paper about one of the finite symmetry groups, then by, I think it's the fundamental theorem of abelian groups or some shit like that, like you're also writing a paper about a lot of other isomorphic groups. And that this type of thing happens. A lot of times you'll read papers. I read a paper a few months ago that was about, it's called like on the minimum number of circuit crossings needed for communicating VLSDI circuits or something. And it's like, it was written about circuits and it is a critical paper in the theory of communication complexity because the problem is isomorphic. So this isn't just a chemistry problem. It's kind of the case that most mathematically dense fields deal with this issue of isomorphic things having different names.
Can I ask a question, Sophia?
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that there are some special molecules that come up all the time and get more common names, yes, like the acetyl-CoA you mentioned before. What happens when someone's writing a paper and they have one weird molecule no one cares about that they have to describe over and over? Like what happens in that situation when maybe it has a page long name that they can't use, but there isn't a household name for it?
So chemists kind of have this attitude where it's like, when you take organic chemistry, we'll spend 2 months teaching you UPAC rules. And then after that, you're never gonna follow them again. So if there isn't a common name already out there, you give it a common name and you say, in this paper, we're calling UPAC name by, I don't know, mango. And then from then on, you refer to it as mango. And then everyone else does too, if you're the first person to come up with a common name. However, it is fairly rare for that to happen because in chemical syntheses, like if we're looking at an organic chemistry paper, the molecules there are fairly interrelated. And so you can often kind of add a prefix or a suffix to the name of something that already exists that you're already dealing with in that synthesis. And that's an appropriate name for the thing you're looking at, based off of, you know, the common chemist attitude, if not UPAC rules.
By the way, a similar problem from math is just thought of is this complexity cafe. So if you guys have visited the Complexity Cafe website, it lists every named complexity class and their proven relationships and their conjectured relationships. And there's a lot of them and the names just get so arduous. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll have these things that are like co-NP modulo, co-co-NP to the PCP or something. And they just become awful. And like, there's no good naming convention and people have tried to have good naming conventions, but it doesn't really work because you want to be able to say the name out loud. And if your convention requires like parentheses co-NP to the, you know, PCP and parentheses to the something else, then it starts becoming gross. And so the very similar problem.
And actually I'll add on that. We have a problem in nomenclature and chemistry that we don't all agree on definitions. So an example is the word ligand, L-I-G-A-N-D. So for biochemists and organic chemists, a ligand is anything that is a substituent group bonding to a molecule, anything. However, for inorganic chemists, it's specifically a type of participant in a coordinate covalent bond. Nothing else would be. And the biologists, the biochemists, they call it a ligand, and the inorganic chemists call it a ligand, but everyone spells it the same. It's the same word. And it has two different meanings. So what that means is that if my background is in biochemistry and I read an inorganic chemistry thing, I could totally miss the point of the paper because I'm working with a different definition of the same exact word. And this comes up all the time.
It reminds me of counting, which is that thing you learn maybe in kindergarten or first grade, but also in the difficult branch of combinatorics that people do their careers in and stuff. I don't mean to derail, so I'm gonna hold off on my question unless there are more about this topic, but I have something if not, so I'll just wait a little bit.
Well, I guess, Sophia, first, thank you very much for making me feel less bad about not knowing chemistry. that's very helpful for me in my emotional state. Like the only way that I would think about like trying to organize things would be thinking of like certain primitives or complexity or classes that like are somehow mappable. broadly, but the thing is that, you know, we don't have a lot of letters because we're only humans. We don't have a big enough language to really describe anything too, like, concisely. So I don't know if there's, like, if there's some sort of, like, you know, I know atoms are the atoms, but if there's some sort of atom that could be used to, like, describe, you know, certain small sets of chemicals together.
Well, there are groups to carry it.
Casual, like,
yeah,
names for things, but, like, yeah, I don't know what, like, what types of, like, if there's already, like, a nomenclature for, like, groups of things that can
serve, absolutely, absolutely. So that's what the periodic table is. And the periodic table, when you're taught it in, like, elementary school, middle school, it's a table, but actually it should be a cylinder because it wraps around. But in this cylindrical table, the columns are groups and the rows are periods. And groups share characteristics. So one would be the halogens. The halogens all have 7 valence electrons and they all behave as nucleophiles in very similar ways. And there's a pile of these. The noble gases is another example. And so in that way, we already have kind of these groupings of things that behave similarly. And then the difference is in their identity, because you can have, like, bromine and iodine, they're both halogens, but they have different numbers of protons and they have different reactivities. And then I won't get too far into it, but we have other ways to group things based off of their nuclear charge, based off of their various quantum numbers and their charge states and their spins. So there are a lot of different characteristics that you could group them by. And we do that graphically in the periodic table just for elements, but it becomes much more difficult to do that once you get to a scale any larger than elements.
Sophia, just so you know, to us as, like, math CS people, atom means, like, the lowest level vocabulary in your grammar or in your language. Okay. And that's what it meant when it was.
But it's not what it means now. Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, just, like, to make what Max is saying a little more concrete, one good example of that would be, like, fused ring nomenclature, and how, you know, that's a fixed unit. It's not, like, chemically indivisible. But for certain molecules, they use, you know, 5 rings and 6 rings and then indexings on those. It's different than UPAC, but I have a screenshot here. But then you just use group rotations between them, mm-hmm. is basically the idea. So, I mean, you're assuming this is just a carbon compound. But that's one example of where they go beyond atoms as your basic unit.
Mm-hmm. And that would mostly be helpful for organic chemists who study reactivity of carbon-containing compounds. So that would be the use of that already and how it's being used, most likely. In the sense that if you have a 6 carbon ring with substituents in certain locations, those are likely to react in similar ways. Just like how the different halogens will react in similar ways.
Sophia, is a common mnemonic device looking at, like, I'm thinking about carotene and carrots, like looking at what the natural, where the molecule is occurring naturally. Is that a common mnemonic device?
Well, I wouldn't call it a mnemonic device. It's more like a nickname. So, you know, if you look at the names of elements historically, a lot of them are things where it's like Einsteinium, because this reminds me of Einstein and I like that guy. So it's totally illogical. But, you know, it's like, I mean, a lot of the names also, you can go back to the Greek language and it refers to a product that they were in. So there's a lot of things like this where the name is like, oh, this is what I used it for, or this is the country I'm from, or this is my last name or someone I like, but it's not logical how those are chosen. It's just how people feel as the discoverer of the element.
Kind of arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In group theory, one way that they handle this type of problem is they have a system called GAP, which is a very cool computer system for group theory made, I think, in Ireland or Scotland. And you can basically put in whatever group you're working with in whatever symbols you want, and it will tell you what groups it is aware of that that thing is isomorphic to. And so then you kind of know what other terms other people might have used to describe the same thing. But you can imagine as you get increasingly large groups, that becomes increasingly computationally difficult because it's sort of like a very complicated graph isomorphism problem or something, which is, I think, NP hard. I'm not remembering at the top of my head. So it's not necessarily like the easiest solution when you have huge molecules.
Can I ask a very off-topic question?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in the middle of your presentation, you talked about studying for the MCAT and being like, oh, you math people, this is actually a small molecule.
Yeah.
And you were saying, thank God it's not a protein, which is interesting to me because I think of a molecule, or I know compound has a different meaning. I don't know what it is, but I think of that as like, oh, there's this thing that you can have a solution and it's acidic or like will poison you somehow. But then I think of protein as something very biological. And it's interesting to me they're made of the same components, which I guess has to be the case. But what differentiates a molecule and a protein, if that's
a protein is a type of molecule. That's it. And so a molecule is any two or more atoms that are bonded together.
But a protein is made of amino acids, right?
Yes.
So you could describe it with the higher level language of the amino acids instead of describing it with the constituent atoms, right?
Well, yes. So there are various ways to describe this. So the way that proteins are formed involves the composing of a polypeptide chain, and each peptide is an amino acid. They're connected by peptide bonds. And maybe you have 1,000 amino acids in a row. So one strategy is you can write the names of these amino acids in the row. You're like, okay, that's a way to represent this. But actually it's not, because the cellular conditions will define the way that that chain folds in on itself. And if your conditions are acidic, it'll end up being one thing. If it's basic, it'll be another thing. If you have a certain hormone in your cell, it'll cause an entirely different thing to happen. And so the end result is this three-dimensional structure that is not equivalent to necessarily like that chain, right? Additionally, there are molecules that come in and they snip off parts in proteins. So it's much more complex than just the chain. That being said, to address your specific question, the phospholipids in a plasma membrane in a cell and the proteins and the amino acids, all of these things are molecules. The only things that you would pay attention to in biochemistry that are not molecules would be ions, neutral atoms, or floating electrons and protons. And that's it. The rest of it are all molecules.
Okay, great. So proteins are a subset of molecules. And if there are no amino acids or anything, then you're probably like, oh, this is just a regular molecule.
Yeah. You can think of it kind of as like a tree structure, where maybe after like 5 to 10, branches on the tree structure, you get to the name protein to describe the thing, but there are lots of other options as you go.
Gotcha. Cool. So one thing that I'm curious about all of your opinions on is I'm super out of my depth with talking about these different things, but I know that the protein folding is also at some point determined by RNA, right? That's something in the process of how that happens.
Absolutely.
And even though it's not always true, there used to be this biological idea that you get information from DNA that goes to RNA, and it doesn't go the other direction, right? Or it's not supposed to, but it does, and people.
Yeah. So.
Is it just generally correct?
To oversimplify it, because I think that's what you're asking for. The central dogma of biology is that DNA is your genetic information, and it's transcribed or copied into messenger RNA, and then messenger RNA goes to a ribosome where it is translated into a polypeptide chain. And that is the like thing that will become a protein once it folds correctly.
Yeah, yeah, perfect. So that's the oversimplification, of course. But what I'm thinking about here that's really interesting is it feels a lot like compilation of some kind, where you have some higher level thing, like maybe the Python is kind of like a DNA, and then that gets compiled down to C, which is lower level, and you can do more stuff with it, but it takes up more space and can have more problems and stuff. And then the C gets compiled to assembly, which is even longer and really specific to the type of computer you have, or maybe what cell it's in or something. And maybe it's not a perfect analogy, but the reason I'm interested in sort of drawing a parallel here, and you can let me know if this is complete nonsense or not, is that compilers are super, super optimized, and it is incredibly difficult to look at the output of compiled code and figure out what the instructions were beforehand, even though it's possible. And when you just have the Python or the C, you don't know what the compilation is going to look like, and it matters based on a host of factors. And
yeah,
I don't know. I think that's a fair analogy to draw out.
Jacob, that's great. It's a really good metaphor. And the one little bit of complexity that I would add is that, of course, you mentioned there's a lot more going on. But one thing is that the proteins that are produced can change or alter the behavior of the DNA itself.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So that's one big difference. I mean, I don't know that much about math or computer science. That's you guys. But I don't know of any examples where the code you make changes the source code, or you know, the end product changes the source code.
Yeah, it's interesting because that feels a lot like a Lisp type thing where data is code, but I've never heard of that going through the full stack of, you have this really high level language that's separate from the assembly.
The only example I think that exists would be things that are inspired by nature, right? Like counterexample, guided inductive synthesis, or evolutionary algorithms, things like that. So like when you get to like graduate level algorithm design, there's certain types of algorithms that are inspired sort of loosely, not too formally by you know, natural selection. And they can do this thing where they'll like write a program and then run it and then see executions that don't really do what they wanted to do, and then use those to patch the program and then try again. Mm-hmm. But, and they might have some randomness put in or something like that, kind of depending on the scheme. But I think it's unusual to say the least, yeah.
Yeah, usually that that patch, there could be good reason for this, because there is that patch. It just usually happens to be the human being like, damn it, my code's broken. Let me go edit the source.
Right.
Yeah.
After inspecting what happens with the assembled stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's sort of teleological. It's like intelligent design.
Yeah. Maybe sometimes not very intelligent.
Yeah, or not with my code right now, it's not very intelligent design. My code's not running and I've got to figure it out every weekend. So yeah, so that's the problem. And we're pretty much at the hour mark. We can go a little farther if anybody has more questions, but if not, we can wrap up and we'll have more biology events in the future. Any outstanding issues we should talk about?
I guess my only question is, you know, related to other projects and other people, are there other organizations that are trying right now to start this process of creating a new nomenclature? Is there like a group that's like trying really hard right now?
Not really that I know of. There are the Smiles people, and I think they're very proud of what they've accomplished. And the majority of chemists are like, yeah, thanks a lot, great. But as far as someone who's actually looking at this from a logical point of view and trying to fix the problem, I don't know of anyone who's doing that.
I think you would need somebody who's at the caliber where they're publishing in Popple, but somehow is willing to take the time to learn a serious amount of chemistry. Sophia and I have spent a lot of time talking about this problem, and I think it's far beyond what I could solve. It's not like I could if I spent like years working on it, but I don't think it's like a intermediate level programming languages problem. It's a very serious programming languages problem.
We're not going to rewrite all of chemistry in an hour.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And I imagine the Smiles people might have had a little bit of of that kind of computer scientist or mathematician's hubris about it. And then probably as they worked through it, they ran into over and over all these reasons why it's much more difficult than you would anticipate. Sophia, I've got a question. Mm-hmm. What do people who operate at the subatomic level do when they want to reason about a molecule while also talking about the subatomic states?
So you mean like when we're discussing the behavior of electrons?
Like, let's say that I want to keep track of the number of quarks or something, mm-hmm. or I don't know, the physicists on this call can tell me what the pieces are, but whatever the like units are that exist below the electron and the neutron and the proton, is there a way to write a molecule while keeping track of all that data?
So this kind of gets to levels.
Okay.
Basically what I'll say is like, if I was writing a paper about a protein, I might tell you the overall charge of the protein, but I wouldn't tell you every single element in the protein that has a negative or positive charge, because there's so many of them. You know, there's a certain amount of space that I can have if I'm writing a paper, and I would not have enough space to list all of that. And it's a very similar situation. Mm-hmm. And so you might draw the structure of a protein if it's a very simple one and draw in the charges, but you wouldn't draw in the complete electron distribution. Okay. Similarly, we don't do the subatomic particles when we're talking about a molecule.
Right.
It's not entirely applicable, and it's also at a much deeper level than any conversation about a molecule will be.
Okay.
That makes me think there's a Maxwell's equations for nomenclature.
Perhaps. I mean, in some sense, you can think of things like Maxwell's equations as being a kind of programming language, because when you have a functional description of a system you're interested in, then you can start reasoning about it symbolically instead of dynamically, right? Or like,
right.
I'm kind of using words in a very loose fashion right now, ironically. But in other words, if you have some sort of like very formal description of the behaviors of a system, then maybe you can reason about kind of many different instances using the formal description rather than reasoning about the kind of individual states that the system could be in or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Sophia, I have a question about learning biology.
Okay.
Because, or chemistry, or whatever you want to call it, but a lot of times there are sort of different ways you can go about learning computation. Uh-huh. Where some people say, oh, go learn math. Computers are just like math on a chalkboard or something, or start out with Python or HTML. Those are nice, easy introductions. And then when you start from like Python or web dev or something, it's quite a hurdle to go learn how CPUs and computers actually work. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you do it in the other direction, you're not as immediately useful, but learning how a CPU manages different instructions makes it easier to be like, oh, I can see the layers that add up to something like Python, and you have a deeper understanding of it, or it's like easier in that direction, even if it's harder at first. Is there sort of a similar thing with chemistry and biology?
Yes, there is. Biology is just the application of biochemistry, and biochemistry is just the application of chemistry. If I were to design the perfect way to learn this material, I would have everyone start with a 400 level inorganic chemistry course. And then after that, do organic chemistry and analytical chemistry and the rest of the chemistry curriculum. And then after that, do biochemistry. And once you understand the biochemistry of all of the metabolic processes in the body, then to move on to biology. And what we call biology, I mean, most of it is actually just biochemistry, but there are some like much higher level things about, you know, behaviors of animals and whatnot. But that's not really worth paying attention to until you understand the underlying content. So if you were going to go about it from like the most pure perspective, you would have to start with inorganic chemistry. And what I will say about that too, is that inorganic chemistry is a lot easier to understand with a physics background.
You can tell we're related. I if you ask me like, how should I learn calculus? I'd be like, well, let's start with Gödel's and completeness theorem.
So are there places that take this direction and say, oh, we're gonna start with inorganic chemistry? Are there resources for that? Or is it just, that's what it would be in an ideal world?
In an ideal world, I mean, that's not how it is here. I took inorganic chemistry last semester after doing a year of organic chemistry. And there are all sorts of things that I learned in inorganic chemistry that would have explained a lot for O-Chem. I didn't learn anything in Gen Chem. I didn't even like chemistry after Gen Chem. It was just bullshit. So at least at the U of A, the way that the curriculum is set up is terrible.
And this is a world-class chemistry program.
Yeah, it's one of the best programs there is. And the courses themselves are great, except for Gen Chem, but the rest of them are great. The problem is the order that they're done in. And it's similar to physical chemistry. Physical chemistry should happen simultaneous to inorganic chemistry, but it doesn't here. And so the inorganic chemistry courses have to spend a lot of time on physical chemistry concepts.
Interesting. Thank you. I'll look into that more.
Cool. So maybe we should wrap up. This was recorded, and I think we'll probably publish the audio and video because I think it's interesting, and there's nothing all that scandalous about what was said today. And although if any of you object, let me know, and then of course we will not publish it. We're going to do more biology events in the future. Some of them will kind of like send out public invites. Some of them, as I said, it's more like 5 minutes beforehand, we ping a few people who we think are interested in that particular topic and say, hey, do you want to jump on Skype and talk about this? Not all of them are recorded, but kind of general topics of interest that I think we'll be talking about in the future involve CRISPR and kind of information theoretic concepts of biology and kind of like, does biology involve error correcting codes? Is there a reason why Claude Shannon is widely cited in ecology, et cetera? The answer to that one's yes. And so I think this is interesting stuff and kind of ground that maybe is well understood by the experts, but not really trodden enough in the public square by kind of morons like us who can make things widely understandable.
To add on to that, I think there's one more area where the club can bring real insight that maybe does not happen as much in academic circles. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of situations where you can take a very specific idea from computer science or biology and flip them and be like, wow, look at this cool thing that applies and here's my paper proving it or something. Mm-hmm. But what I think can get missed is a lot of analogies, which can actually be quite useful, but are more difficult to pin down. Like for example, oh, CRISPR kind of keeps a list of these different things that have been seen before. And when there's something there, it goes through and checks. And if it matches the list, then you do something. And it's sort of like, oh, that's like a lot like a for loop that we'd use in regular programming and like kind of like malware fingerprinting in a way. And it's hard to be definitive about those things, but it's definitely interesting to think about and discuss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So thanks for joining us. And Sophia, thanks for the presentation.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you, Sophia.
Thank you.
Okay. Adios, guys.